copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I want to give you a little bit of information from the clinical literature, because I think it's so vital in working with people who've been traumatized. There's a three-phase model for working with trauma that's pretty effective. The first phase is called safety and stabilization. The second stage is when you're really processing the memories of the stories. The third stage is strengthening present tense relationships, goals, purpose, and moving more into the outside world in a different relationship with the trauma than before. But the first phase, which is called safety and stabilization, is probably the most critical part. Everybody thinks it's the memories, but it's actually this. And it's not only critical, but it's the recovery is not linear. So you do safety and stabilization, which I'll elaborate on in a minute. Then you get into some of the memories and somebody, I don't know, wants to use alcohol again or just is completely overwhelmed. You go back and do safety and stabilization. Then you move a little bit more through the memories and you go back to safety and stabilization. Or they have an outside crisis in their life, so you go back to that. And you keep in mind, particularly in the area of complex trauma, that we are working with people who don't know how to feel safe or be stable. Nobody ever taught them or let them be that way. So it is one of the most foundational building blocks to trauma recovery. And it means several things. Number one, it's about their physical safety. Many people with these histories do things that are not safe or live in situations that are not safe. And so you need to assess for that. Is it safe in the home where they are now? Are they physically safe in the home they're in? Other assessments in terms of their safety outside of your office. Are they safe from themselves? Do they want to kill themselves? Do they cut? Are they weighing 80 pounds or whatever it would be here? Because they don't eat, they're anorexic. Are they drinking so much alcohol or using so many drugs that you can't do any work with them until those things are worked on and rehab has to be first before trauma therapy, whatever. So you need to assess all of those things so the person is as safe as they can possibly be and as stable as they can possibly be. And the stabilizing refers to some of the things I mentioned before, such as, what are you going to do with yourself when you feel overwhelmed? How are you going to take care of yourself? What are you going to do when you feel extreme rage? And how are you going to stop yourself from actually being homicidal? And so it involves things like teaching them how to breathe. It usually involves a visit to the medical doctor to make sure nothing else is contributing to what you're working with. It involves teaching them that things like aerobic exercise can diminish anger, and also kick in endorphins, which is the runner's high, which helps people feel calm. And it can help with depression, which many of them are depressed. So, and another thing that I work really hard to do with my clients is teach them how to look for beauty, because they don't know how to do that. They're so focused on trying not to get hurt again. That's really the primary thing in their minds. And so they don't, you know, I'll give them an assignment. You know, in the next week or two, three times, I want you to spend 10 minutes outside, find one thing that you think is beautiful, write it down and bring it back to me. So you're trying to get them to use their brain a little bit differently. I've had clients say to me, I never knew till I did this work that flowers were actually different colors. So we're talking pretty basic stuff here. So safety and stabilization. The other piece of that is their relationship with you. You have to build trust. You need to form an alliance. And that takes a long time. And you need to be okay with that and not take it personally. You know, they're sure you're going to run away, quit seeing them, hurt them, and any number of other things, tell everybody else their story, and you keep saying, this is what's true, this is what's true, no, I, you know, and they still don't believe you. And a lot of times people start to feel like it's all about them, but it's really not all about them. What they're bringing you are the things they learned while they were being traumatized. And now you're going to say you're the exception to that, but they've never met an exception before. So why should they believe your words? So it's something that happens little by little over time. And one of the things that protects the relationship are clear boundaries. So when somebody first comes to see me and they have a trauma history, one of the things I will do is tell them what I do and what I don't do. This is what you can expect, because again, predictability helps people feel safe. They lived in very unpredictable environments. They don't even know what boundaries are, except fighting somebody off so they don't get hurt or those kinds of things. So I explain to them what to do in an emergency or not. I explain to them that I do not stay attached to my email by an umbilical cord. And because the work is so compelling, many, many therapists do not do this well. How do you handle crisis phone calls? How long is the session? You know, when you come and see me, I'll spend X amount of time with you, and then you keep extending and extending and extending it. And so what happens is you end up with two chaotic people, and that's, again, not a good outcome. So you need to figure out how you're going to do this in a way that builds trust and helps them and takes care of you. Because there are two people in the room, not just one. And so, for example, I've had people tell me that they got involved in working with somebody who was severely traumatized in their church and hadn't really had any training or read anything. So the person kept locking themselves in the bathroom at their house and threatening to kill herself. So this person who was helping went and spent a whole weekend in the bathroom. That's hospital time if somebody's that suicidal. And so people think that if they don't do everything, they're not going to be helping. And that's false. And as I said in the previous session, you know, you are not the person's Xanax. You're not the pill that they pop every time they feel bad. And if you act as if you are, you teach them dependence on you, and you continue what they didn't get during the trauma, and that is skills for caring for themselves. So I just want you to know how central that is. It's not like this little thing we establish verbally and then we do the real work with the memories. You are literally working with and in some ways training this person how to live a healthy life during this stage. And it needs to be revisited because they don't hold on to it very long because they never saw it before. Telling a story of personal trauma is full of risks. Some of you have trauma histories and you know something about those risks. The story can be told in a variety of circumstances. Counseling is not the only place people tell their trauma stories. Sometimes they're seeking prayer in a church. Sometimes it's in a police report. Sometimes it's in front of a court. Sometimes people are doing research on trauma and they knock on somebody's door and they want them to tell their story. It is not uncommon for hearers to encourage the tellers to tell in ways that serve a good end, but hurt the victim. So you can be well-intentioned, you want this person to heal, but you end up pushing them into prayer, and they're not really even sure God exists at that point. And again, you can want to do blessed, wonderful things for them coercively, in which case you are repeating the dynamics of trauma. So it's very important to be aware of that. You do not want to damage an already damaged person. The other piece about this is the victim themselves can run over themselves. So they just want to blurt the story out. Or that I have a book on the threshold of hope that is written for victims of sexual abuse. And in the beginning, of the chapters are all very short. In the beginning, I say, basically, do not read this at night. And do not read the whole book in one sitting. You're going to re-traumatize yourself. So periodically, somebody will come to see me on a clinical basis, and they, you know, I always ask about the referral or whatever. And, well, I read your book. Oh, and how was that? Well, I disobeyed everything you said, and it made me a mess. So You want them to not do that to themselves just as much as you don't want to do that either, and that needs to be taught. Over here are Erikson's stages of development. And I'm using them just as a tool. But what he does is take different points in a child's life into adulthood, and I left off the one for those of us over 65, which it can impact that stage too, but I ran out of room at the bottom anyway. What he does is take the different stages of childhood and talk about the things that you're going to learn that are good or bad. So, for example, for the infant, which is the first 18 months, so this is a baby who's born up until a year and a half. The thing that the baby is learning during that stage is trust versus mistrust. Are these people who take care of me trustworthy? And if not, okay. And what's developing, he says, is hope. Because if, you know, I'm little and I skin my knee because I'm trying to walk and I don't do a very good job, and I try to find somebody to help me with my skinned knee and I get boxed in my ears, what am I going to learn? I'm certainly going to learn that I can't trust people to help me when I hurt. And over time, I won't even hope for it. So you understand what the stages then are about, and each one has it. I have the ages and the things that you're learning or not learning. Now let me just, I'm going to read a poem that's from the patient. And this is a poem that is written about her experience, and I want you to think about these things in complex trauma while you listen to it, and then you think about these two questions. This is someone who was abused by her mother. So here's what she wrote. It's actually not even finished, but... You never tucked me in at night or sang a special song. You never kissed my boo-boos or told me I belong. You never sat down on my bed to help me get to sleep or came and dried my tears when you would see me weep. You never held me close so I could feel your heartbeat next to mine or ran your hand across my face, memorizing my design. You never took the time to read a bedtime story so I could dream of a far-off place and land where the good was as it seemed. You never cared I couldn't eat the food upon my plate, or that I could hardly swallow from the throat sores that would not abate. You never shielded me from ugly. In fact, you are the one that I struggle with the most and fear I will become. That little girl that you gave life, who never left your side, you took her and you ruined her and did nothing while she died. I remember now, though I would rather forget, how you twisted things and kept me in fear, how you never put me first, and I remember ugly things you said that no one else should ever hear. It's taken all these years to put together what you did, to try and understand the things, but I can assure you, you've nothing to really fear, because I will never tell the words you used and you abused and caused my life to feel like hell. Where do I start? How do I say Happy Mother's Day to the one who used me for herself in such cruel and disgusting ways? Happy Mother's Day to your mother, the monster that you are, the one who never saw me and made my life bizarre. Now you think about that poem and the questions. What kind of lies did this child learn about who she is? About who others are? What did she learn as an adolescent? And you look at the things she should have been learning. So you can list. She learned mistrust. She learned, you know, all those things. And when you sit across from a lovely, well put together, competent adult, this is who she is. Part of the purpose of what you were doing is that when people come in front of us with terrible suffering, we feel like we're supposed to fix it. And so we often start talking long before we should. You can't fix 15 years of brutal rape by a father. It can't fix 5 years on the streets as a 16-year-old trafficked. So we have to work with ourselves in order to change what we think our goal is or what we're supposed to do. And the first is that we really understand the person in front of us. And again, that's part of what that exercise was about. It's not just the person you see, but who they've been throughout the lifespan before they came to you. And you want to truly see them. When I was in Rwanda several years ago, I've been back and forth many times, there was a wonderful man there, a godly man, who lived through the genocide. And he said, after the genocide, we did not think we were human. We forgot that we were human, which is not hard to do if people run around calling you cockroaches. And of course, you know what we do with cockroaches. And he said, you, I was with a group of people, you all came and listened, and you saw us, and now we remember we are human. Don't underestimate the power of listening and understanding in a person's life. That's part of the healing before you ever make a suggestion. Let me just talk to you briefly about vicarious trauma. Trauma's contagious. In the role of witness, it's easy for us to get emotionally overwhelmed. And what happens is that we, if we're really working and understanding and entering in, we end up, though to a lesser degree, with the same feelings of anger and despair. And it's known as vicarious traumatization. We end up struggling with disruptions in our relationships as you're repeatedly exposed to stories of human atrocities and cruelty. Your faith will be challenged. So we end up beginning to share the client's feelings of helplessness. I don't know what to say about this. I don't know what to do with the story. I don't know how to handle it. Well, that's how they feel all the time. So it's very important to use what you feel to inform you also about their experience. We end up identifying with them through their profound grief and feel sometimes like we are also in mourning for what goes on in this world. And unless we know how to take care of ourselves, we will not be able to continue to bear witness because we will burn up, dry up, fall away. So it is an occupational hazard, vicarious traumatization, if you do any kind of work with trauma survivors. But it is not something people do to us, but rather it is a human consequence of having empathy. Because when you have empathy, you open up a door to your heart and other things get in it. So if you really have empathy for somebody who's been traumatized, the horrific things that have happened to them will come through that door in your heart, and you can easily find yourself also overwhelmed and shutting down. So self-care is pretty important, and there's some irony to that because you're trying in safety and stabilization and all the way through to teach these people how to be safe and stable, which requires self-care. That's very easy for us to drop that in our own lives. It means physical things. Food, exercise, sleep, medical care, schedule, recreation, all of those things. We are working with people who are in crisis and don't know how to take care of their bodies. And if we don't take care of ours, we're mirroring them. That's backwards. Sometimes in imminent crises right in the moment, those things are unavoidable. But if we continue for the long haul not to care for ourselves physically, emotionally, spiritually, we will not continue or we will become dangerous to the victims. We all need good supportive relationships because those have a tremendous impact on our own resiliency and mental health. Pain tends to isolate. And after you've heard some stories of horrific trauma, you go places and you think, nobody knows. I've had the experience of standing up in church to sing a hymn and thinking, if they had any idea what's in my head, they wouldn't believe it. That's vicarious trauma. So it's very important that we have people in our lives who know us and care for us and pray for us. I have found it extremely critical to have those who understand trauma as my companions along the way, and who we get together and pray for ourselves and for our clients. I think that's a vital supporting column to the work. And I personally have found my faith challenged in some significant ways over these four decades. Evil and suffering have a tremendous capacity to swallow up faith and hope. One of the things that I have learned is that evil and suffering also provide an opportunity for me to see exposed the weak places in my faith. And I have been a student of my trauma clients as much as they have been mine, and God has used evil, their stories, to teach me more about himself. Evil and despair can distort our thinking. You know, if you work with enough sexual abuse victims, you think everybody you meet is a perpetrator. If you work with war violence and atrocities and trafficking and things, it carries all of that evil and isolation and chaos into you. So it means you must deliberately seek out for yourself the antidotes of what you work with. You work with ugly, look for beauty, just like you tell a client. You work with chaos, have order in your life. You work for screaming emotions, you need to learn peace and quiet. They're the antidotes to the poison that you sit with, and it is poison. I've realized even more clearly in recent years that these antidotes, of course, are not just helpful in coping with the effects of the work, but they're actually part and parcel of a life that is obedient to God. Many caregivers, I find, feel guilty about pursuing beauty and peace and order in their lives, knowing of the chaos and torment in the lives of those they serve. It's as if somehow we shouldn't have good in our lives because of the terrible suffering other people have. But the Word of God says he gives us richly all good things to enjoy. To turn from those things is to turn from his hand in your life. And even more, these things that are antidotes are tastes of his character, because who is life? God is. Who is beauty? He is. He's harmony. He's glory. We need to pursue and soak in the things that are of him, not only so we can endure, but so that we bear his fragrance while we endure. So let me just give you a few closing thoughts on vicarious traumatization, and then I'll give you this little homework thing for you to think about overnight. And then somebody will show up and make an announcement, and we'll be through. You and I are image bearers. And years ago, one of the things that struck me about that is, if I can bear an image, that means I'm shapeable. You know, you look in a mirror and see yourself, the mirror doesn't change, right? You pick up clay and do something, it changes. We are image bearers, so we are therefore capable of bearing an image. We are impacted by what we sit with. And if I habitually sit with trauma, I will bear the image of trauma in my person. I have been profoundly moved and anchored through my own struggles with this work by the fact that as I walk through the trauma of others and live with its impact on my life, I am actually following in the footsteps of our Savior. He became flesh and blood. He entered into our trauma. He literally took our sin and suffering on himself, and he is eternally scarred by it. Oswald Chambers, in speaking of Jesus, refers to the whole world's anguish being forced through the channels of a single heart. So you think about vicarious trauma. It affects our identity. His was eternally altered. He who was God became man. It damages connection. He who was one with the Father cried out, "Why have you forsaken me?" Trauma overwhelms us with strong emotion. My soul is sick unto death. I am deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow. Trauma threatens our sense of safety. He was abandoned by the Father and entered hell himself. So whatever the work does to you, it did it to him. He went before us and is in the room with us and is in us. Paul says in Colossians 1:24, I find joy amid my sufferings for you, and I fill up in my person whatever is lacking in Christ's affliction on behalf of his body, the church. So as we sit with the trauma stories of others and feel it reverberate throughout our persons, our minds, our lives, remember that there is nothing that Jesus Christ has called us to do that he has not already done. And in doing what he did, we bring his comfort, his healing to those whose lives are so damaged by evil. Not only has he endured the same things in far greater measure, he has promised to be with us and in us to do the work that is before us. So pursuit of him in all areas of our lives is vital, or we will not bring his image to our clients. We will only end up mirroring them instead. To work with the trauma that's in the world today is to work with lies and darkness and evil. It is frankly hell brought up from below to the earth's surface. And you can't fight the litter of hell in other people's lives unless you walk dependent on the Spirit of God. It is a work that is a great privilege to do. It is work that is difficult to do. The task of serving as a representative of the character of God so that others can grasp who he really is and begin to believe in him is far beyond my capability or yours. But I can promise you that if you'll let it, working with traumatized people will take you to your knees with a heart that is hungry for more of God, so that you might in turn bring his presence in very concrete ways and concrete places where he has not yet been known. The most amazing thing about this work is that he uses such horror to teach me more of himself. How redemptive is that? And in that process, I begin to watch his image shine out of the distorted and damaged human being in front of me.